Hi, this is Bud Colligan with Mike Boych at our next installment of Pod Summit, and we're here today with Sunil Paul, the founder and CEO of both Freeloader and Brightmail, and now a very active angel investor and technology luminary. So Sunil, welcome to Pod Summit.
Thanks, Bud. Happy to be here.
Great. What Mike and I wanted to talk to you today about was first, maybe you can give our audience a little bit of background. Sunil graduated from Vanderbilt, worked in the government for a number of years with NASA, with the Space Station Information Systems, worked at the Office of Technology Assessment for Congress, and then really got the bug and went from D.C. to Virginia to work as AOL's first internet product manager. And so, you know, I thought maybe for our audience you can just give a brief overview from there of how it was getting into the internet with AOL as the first product manager there. And I thought that would be a good jumping off point for you to describe a little bit about what it was like in those days at AOL, 1994, 95, and then how that led to your entrepreneurial activities at both Freeloader and Brightmail subsequently.
Yeah, it was an amazing time at AOL. I joined, they had internet email, and they had just launched Gopher and Waze, which I don't think anyone remembers anymore except people who were involved back then. So when I joined, internet was kind of a sideshow at AOL. We introduced file transfers and the web and I've forgotten something else. Oh, news groups. But during that two-year period, the internet went from being a sideshow to being the main event at AOL. And we went from something like 300,000 subscribers to 3 million subscribers. We went from, you know, something like 100 employees to 1,000 employees. We had a 10x increase in revenue. I mean, everything just was exploding. So it was an amazing time to be there. And I also, because of where I was, I also got exposure to sort of what was going on in the internet, all the latest companies, and we were involved in a lot of acquisitions. So it was an exciting time to be there.
And then how did that lead to Freeloader and subsequently to Brightmail as well, just in terms of your entrepreneurial bug?
Yeah, well, even before I went to AOL, one of the reasons I went to AOL was to get experience in business, in entrepreneurship, in software, because I didn't have that. I'd been working in the government. And I still had this bug. I had ideas from that I'd been noodling on ever since I was at the previous place, OTA. And I was trying to convince this guy at AOL, who I knew. I was like, you know, I've got this idea about these interesting things where you can download things onto your computer, and you know, we should go start a company. And he was like, no way. I've got, you know, I don't remember how much he had, but I had $1 million of unvested stock. And if I just stayed there for another 4 years, I would have made another $1 million. And he's like, there's no way I'm leaving this on the table. But I've got this guy at dinner who's always trying to convince me to leave AOL as well. Why don't you have dinner with him and leave me out of it? So I had dinner with his friend, Mark Pincus. And I think after the first meeting with him, I thought, there's no way I could ever start a business with this guy. But Mark is an amazing guy, and he's a great business person. So after a couple of meetings, we sort of, you know, figured out better idea of how it could work, and also worked out the personal dynamic with us between the two of us. And I made the decision. I made the leap, went and started the company. And, you know, of course, 6 months later, we sold it for $38 million. So it turned out to be a good decision, although, interestingly enough, financially, I probably would have made the same amount if I'd stayed at AOL.
With those options, it continued
well,
to rise.
Well, the options, the stock price increased by a huge amount after that. So I would have made even more even if I had just stuck around. But as far as I'm concerned, it was a fantastic decision because it satisfied my desire to become an entrepreneur. And, you know, there are just certain times when ideas get ripe. There are times when you have to take the plunge. And, you know, before I joined AOL, it was the wrong time. I didn't have the expertise. And I think timing-wise, a lot of the internet phenomena had not yet happened. But I sensed back then that this was the time that I had to go chase this now, and we were right. I mean, there's a company called Pointcast that launched literally the same internet world that we did. So we were right. I mean, we were at the right time and managed to get acquired. And, of course, famously, PointCast, 6 months later, got an offer for, I think, about 10 times as much as...
Yeah, $300 million.
Yeah. And they they turned down the offer.
Right.
So I think we were the only ones that made money on the whole push phenomenon.
So was this a case of having an idea that you just had to realize, or was it more about wanting to start a company and finding an idea that would do the job?
It was both. I mean, I definitely had a desire to become an entrepreneur, but part of that desire was because I have all these ideas percolating, and you know, sometimes when you have those ideas percolating, it just drives you nuts not to be able to go do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the next chapter is Brightmail.
Yeah, so...
Was that a case of first-person experience that led you to understand the spam problem before others, or was it widely perceived as a problem at that point?
It was seen as a problem. This was late 97, and the acquiring company had shut down Freeloader, so I didn't have a lot to do. And my wife had started complaining about these messages that were being sent to her on her AOL account, you know, advertising pornography and asking her to donate money and all kinds of things like that. And I started looking into it and saying, well, I was getting a few as well. And it was intriguing. It was intellectually interesting. And I was also thinking about, I don't know, maybe 10 other ideas of different companies to start. And as I started thinking about the spam problem, I came up with a couple of ideas. And one idea I came up with was sort of this client software solution that I won't go into the details, but I thought, this is interesting, and maybe I can patent this and maybe license it to somebody someday. But then as I started digging into it more and I started talking to more and more people, I said, you know, out of all the different ideas you're talking about, this spam thing, I really hate spam. And at the same time, I started realizing that if this problem started getting worse, that it could really threaten the viability of email. And if we as sort of entrepreneurs and the industry didn't do something about it, the government would do something about it, and that solution would be far worse. So a lot of those sort of continue to motivate me to figure it out. But I still had this client solution idea. And I went and talked to a couple of different ISPs, including AOL. And they were like, yeah, client software, we don't really like it, but if you had a good solution, we'd take a look at it. And but then I started thinking about server-side solutions and hit upon this idea that became Brightmail. And then when I took that idea back to the same ISPs, they're like, yeah, server-side solution, we like that. We think this whole approach, if it worked, we'd buy it. And it was when I got that kind of feedback, that was sort of a critical point. I said, okay, if these ISPs will buy onto it, then there's definitely a company here. Now, the big question was, can it be a big company? And I didn't really want to waste my time on a small company. So then I started thinking, well, okay, well, if ISPs have the problem now, then eventually spammers will realize that there's this huge market in corporate accounts. And the fact that ISPs have been the first ones to introduce email addresses, as more and more corporations get on board, there are going to be more and more addresses. And so eventually corporations will have the problem. They'll pay more. And once you have this software installed into the infrastructure of the email systems, you'll be able to add more and more capability onto the email. So all of those factors together, I said, okay, well, actually, this could be a big company. And that's when I decided, let's go turn this into a real company.
And ultimately, it was a big company. It got sold in 2004 to Symantec for $370 million. I'm wondering, as you think over from when you started in 97 to 2004, you've got 7 years. When you think back on that experience for other entrepreneurs in our audience, what were some of the critical points, either decisions or hires or strategic relationships or market changes that really impacted the company's success?
Well, there are lots. I think a few of them in the early stages, just getting the initial founding team was critical because, I mean, I was literally sitting in my basement wearing fuzzy slippers and a bathrobe talking to AT&T, trying to convince them to give me a $100,000 prepayment on 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 this system that I hadn't even created, and I had one employee who was not a software developer. So going from that to having a real team, you know, having people like Dan Aronson, who had built big scalable software before, people who like Chris Madsen, who had gone out and sold big systems before. I mean, getting that founding team was critical. Obviously, getting the first round of funding that started out as an angel round got very big, and luckily one of those angels was Bud Colligan, who's also at Excel, and we turned into that a very successful venture round. I think another significant big change for the company was when spam went from being an ISP problem to being a corporate problem. And that wasn't something we had control over. Honestly, I expected it to happen a lot sooner than it did. I think it probably happened around 2002, if memory serves correctly. I don't remember exactly. But you know, suddenly we had customers in the corporate world who were willing to pay 10 times as much as per email address as ISPs were. And that really transformed the company, because suddenly we could sell the same product with modifications rather than having to add more and more capability to our existing product.
There are spam solutions out there today that are more essentially authenticating good senders and charging them a tax to bypass the spam machinery in places like AOL. I guess I'm thinking of companies like Goodmail, and that's attracted some level of controversy. What's your take on that aspect of the business?
Well, I think in some sense what Goodmail's doing is a small step beyond what AOL was already doing. They were already blocking certain email if it didn't pass their own internal screens. I think the big question becomes if people have to start paying for the delivery of mail. There's always the threat that you're going to end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, there's this fantastic medium of email, and one of its great values, what's so fantastic about it is it's so easy to send a lot of email to people. And if it suddenly costs a lot of money to do that, then it's sort of the poison is, or the medicine is sort of worse than the disease. I actually don't know enough about what the details of Goodmail is doing to sort of pass any kind of judgment about it. But I do think in principle there's nothing wrong with charging large bulk mailers, legitimate bulk mailers, to deliver mail. But it's a question of what do you define as large.
Mm-hmm. So, Sunil, after these couple companies, you had one sort of quick flip and another one that got built over a period of time where you had a substantial outcome. What were some of the lessons that you could take from that you apply to new companies that you're working with today, or just learnings that you could share with our audience?
Yeah. I think one sort of idea that has informed a lot of the things that I look at in companies to invest in or new companies to start is paying a lot more attention to realistic timeframes to profitability. Because I think in both those companies, I did not have a realistic sense of what it would take to get to profitability. And the transformation that happened at Brightmail once we got profitable was dramatic and important, because suddenly you're in charge of your own universe. Instead of, you know, worrying about when you're going to run out of money and being at the whim of whoever your next round of funding is going to be provided by, instead, you're in control. You get to decide where we're going to invest. Should we raise money because we want to make this active decision to invest in whatever direction? So, paying a lot more attention to profitability would be one big lesson that I've learned. I think, I don't know, there's the usual things about, it's a lesson of paying attention to the founding team and paying attention to what kind of I don't know. A lot of these are just sort of lessons that are minor lessons. I don't know. The big lesson, I think, for me was the profitability question. And I suppose one other big question is, or one other big thing I learned is, you have to have a plan for what happens if what you think is going to happen with the marketplace doesn't quite happen when you think it's going to happen. I mean, in the case of Brightmail, you know, the corporations didn't have the spam problem until about 2 years after I thought it would happen, roughly. And, you know, I think we sort of struggled with what do we do? You know, what do we add? What direction do we go? And so I think we would have done much better if we sort of had a plan for, okay, if it turns out doesn't turn out to be a problem, then what do we do?
So clean tech, that seems like something pretty unrelated to all your prior adventures, and also I'm wondering how rapidly those companies can achieve profitability. Back to the big lesson. So tell us a little bit about what got you excited about clean tech and what kind of things you're looking at there.
You know, the story behind the clean tech thing is I was in the shower one day, and I was thinking, it was during this time of, well, yeah, it was during the time of Brightmail when the corporate thing hadn't quite hit. And I was like, well, let's see, what are some ways that we could, I was actually thinking about ways that we could maybe take the fact that we were filtering all this mail and we're filtering out bad marketing messages. Was there a way that we could somehow turn that into a method for delivering good marketing messages? And I was noodling on different ideas, and then I thought to myself, is this really the way I want to spend the rest of my life, focusing on ways to deliver better marketing messages to people? And that sort of planted the seed when a friend of mine, Martin Rauschenstein, who had started a previous email company, he came to me and said, you know, I've got this new company. It's a little bit different than most, but I want you to take a look, see if you might be interested in investing. Well, it was a company called NanoSolar, and they had a way of making photovoltaics, solar cells, to convert sunlight to electricity in a better, cheaper way. And in the course, so I did a lot of due diligence because I knew nothing about solar, I knew nothing about energy. I had a little bit of background in nanotechnology from that study I'd done a long time ago, but not really any great depth. So I spent a lot of time looking into it, and in the course of it, I realized, wow, this is a real market, and this is not just a bunch of hippies out there, you know, trying to figure out how to produce energy from sunlight. It was a real business, and there were good, solid reasons for going into it. And what NanoSolar was trying to do was make it into even much more compelling, just gargantuan business, and the scale of the business was tremendous. And then on top of that, you've got all the factors that sort of encourage a greater focus on clean energy and clean technology. I mean, there are sort of these big macro forces at work of global climate change at the highest level. But even if we can't manage to get our act together and put caps on carbon dioxide in the U.S. and China and India, there are still tremendous pressures to provide cleaner energy and cleaner goods and cleaner manufacturing processes throughout the world. And that is, I think, an inexorable push. I mean, you look at, you know, the concerns about things like energy security have come and gone, but ever since the 60s, for decades upon decades, we have consistently pushed the for cleaner and cleaner environment. So that is a large global phenomenon that's not going to change. And at the same time, we've got this climate change thing that is also adding greater urgency to that problem. The other big fundamental is that this is just a gargantuan industry. Trillions of dollars spent on various kinds of energy. Just electricity alone is a multi-trillion-dollar market in the U.S., not to mention worldwide. And then you add the sort of liquid fuel, transportation fuel sector as well. Another multi-trillion-dollar business. So making even minor inroads into those marketplaces represent huge opportunities. So all of this together made me realize, wow, the final component is that there are all these advances happening in nanotechnology and biotechnology, advances in semiconductors and in material science, and very few of them have been applied to the problem of energy. This is 4 years ago, I think I said. This is all sort of conventional wisdom now. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, okay, I should be paying a lot more attention here. So my kids were young, and I wanted to be able to spend more time with them. So I decided, well, I'm going to start investing in this space. And so ever since, I've been an investor in clean energy companies. And, you know, I sort of look at clean tech companies every once in a while. In other words, sort of clean materials and all that. But I really, even just the energy space is so incredibly complex. It's hard to be an intelligent investor in just energy. And frankly, I don't even feel like I understand all the different energy components, much less clean water and clean mm-hmm. materials and all that. So,
could you describe a couple of the deals that you're invested in now in the clean tech space and sort of what led you to those investments?
Yeah. So one is NanoSolar. Their basic approach is to use advances in nanotechnology to take solar cells from being something that right now involves high temperature processing, vacuum chambers, very expensive equipment to produce, and turn it into something that can be produced at very low cost with very low capital cost for the equipment to produce it. So right now, if you want to produce a factory that'll produce, say, 100 megawatts of production per year in solar cells, more or less that'll cost you $100 million to produce that factory. Using the techniques that NanoSolar is developing, you should be able to produce that kind of factory for an order of magnitude less money. And the cost of electricity produced from these panels, they're hoping can be brought down to the point where they'd be competitive in the beginning with a retail grid, in other words, the price you pay from your utility, but eventually even with the wholesale grid, in other words, competitive with electricity produced by nuclear plants and coal plants and windmills and hydroelectric. So that's one that's very interesting. And
Did you get involved there prior to them raising institutional money? What stage was the company in?
I was very first money in. So it was basically a bunch of people it's classic sort of Silicon Valley story. It was a bunch of people that Martin knew, the CEO. So it's me, the two Google guys, one of their brothers, Carl, Mark Pincus, I know there's a few others in there as well. Oh, Reid Hoffman, LinkedIn CEO. We all came in, and that was a company where I helped make introductions to people, to USVP in particular, that ended up leading the first round. So the first round was USVP and Benchmark. Another company that I invested in is Advent Solar. Mm-hmm. You know, part of the story there is I went to a conference in Japan about photovoltaics, solar cells. And at this conference, I told people I'd invested in NanoSolar, and the typical reaction was they'd shake their heads and say, I don't understand why all you guys are investing in this nano stuff and organics. I don't understand. You could have come ask me. I don't think it's going to work. And so it kind of, frankly, made me pretty nervous. And I also heard a presentation there about a professor who's been in the field for a while, and his hypothesis that the existing technology basically had enough ways to get down to being competitive with the retail grid on its own, and that roughly by year 2020, more or less, the existing industry would get to that price point, which is interesting. It has all kinds of other implications for what's going to happen with energy. But that made me realize, well, you know, this this whole battle of getting away from being having solar cells produced based on silicon, which is the way that almost all solar cells are produced based on silicon today, and moving to other kinds of materials. You know, we had a similar scenario happening with the semiconductor world, where for years people thought, well, silicon's not going to be able to continue to the advances. We're going to need to move to gallium arsenide or some other kinds of materials. And yet silicon, because it had so much momentum, because it had so much research, because it was so well characterized, it just kept going down the cost curve and just kept its advances. And so that really resonated with me, and I thought, well, I need to go start looking at what's happening in the silicon world and see if there's some advances there that I can place a bet on. So I came across Advent Solar. Two really smart guys. Part of what I really liked about them is that they had a CEO who had run a silicon PV company before, photovoltaics company before. The technologist had come out of Sandia. He was the inventor of the technology. And they basically had a very interesting advance that they're going to be able to advance the sort of state of silicon processing technology a leap ahead of where the rest of the industry is going to be. And very briefly, it basically, I don't know how much we want to go into the details here. You want to hear the details?
Well, it's, you can just summarize this because we're going to come back to it in a minute, but just
okay,
go ahead.
So it's a way of making cells so that they're more aesthetically pleasing and that they're easier and cheaper to assemble and that they can be thinner than typical cells, because that reduces the cost a lot. So anyway, I invested in the first round there along with a group up in Seattle called Angels with Attitude, another angel group. And then again, I helped them figure out, they had a hard time raising their first round. It was a long haul because, well, we can go into it, I think mainly because companies like NanoSolar had come along and had a lot of excitement around them in the venture community. And these guys looked relatively, I don't know,
pedestrian,
kind of pokey compared to all the sexy nanotech stuff. But then an interesting thing happened, which is this company SunPower started getting traction. And SunPower also has a similar way of putting contacts on the back. And, you know, we're sort of talking about this significant advance in the silicon world, but not, you know, not a major breakthrough, just a significant advance. And they were getting great traction. And people started talking about, oh, wow, Cypress, which owned 80% of this company, you know, they were adjusting their revenue projections upward because of their solar division. And then there were rumors that they're going to start going public. And suddenly Advent got a lot more interest from venture capitalists.
Well, I think the story of Advent Solar is a good segue for our next part, because we'll conclude the part one of our interview with you now. But for our listeners, I think they should stay tuned to part two, because we're going to be talking more about angel investing and also about India and the explosion of tech and of venture capital interest and of entrepreneurs in the Indian market as well.
Great.